Okay. Soil Seed Starter, I want you to listen to this podcast and I want you to understand that when you are bringing together knowledge from different disciplines, it's often the same knowledge that is used many times. What I want you to understand is when you're eating proven bread, we're linking you microbially to the soil, to germination, to fermentation, to your gut, and then to the neurotransmitters that your gut makes for your brain health. Now, this particular podcast was recorded in the potting shed just down there, and it was a day when I gathered my students around and they really wanted to make those connections. And I hope that you will take the time to listen to this, and I really kind of bring together some concepts that tell you more about the way that we think about our bread and about the process of fermentation and why it relates back to the proven bread. Most people don't expect that I take them in the potting shed to learn to bake. And this is the barn or the potting shed at the Sado School. And it's a place where I need to join some dots. And the dots that I want to join is about understanding the system and understanding fermentation. And once you understand this, you're going to make a much better baker. And it's in understanding this that you realise that we are connected to the whole process. And what we've managed to do through industrialization and through streamlining our food and making our food into a commodity is we have disconnected from the whole process. And once you've disconnected, then anything you build on top of the first mistake that was made is building on something that's broken. So we're building on a system that broke a long, long time ago, and I'm going to explain that now. So I look at bread as an evolutionary food. We evolved eating bread, and I've spoken about this before. There is evidence of sugrum being ground at the back of a cave over 200,000 years ago in Mozambique. It's called archaeobotany. And we see that we were gathering seeds, and we must have realised that, you know, we, I guess birds eating them, animals eating them, we could eat them. What we don't have is seven stomachs, because I would like to say most of us are not cows. But we cannot ferment them in our gut. And the same with grain, we can't ferment them in our gut. But we have the advantage, because with our cognition and our understanding, we are able to use the microbial process that is naturally around us to process our food for us. And it's this process that we evolved with as part of us that is actually what we've disconnected from. So we start with soil. I've got a little bit of soil in here, and I've written about this. This is soil. And in this soil, there are more microbes in this teaspoon of soil than there are stars in the sky. It's absolutely packed. This 9 inches keeps us on the planet. It's the soil and this system of birth and life and death in the soil system that is essentially a planet that constantly, day in, day out, ferments. The whole planet is microbial. There's microbes in the sea. There's microbes in volcanoes. There's microbes that live right at the top of mountains. And all these microbes, these bacteria, there's archaea, there's yeast, there's bacteria, and they all adapt to live in different environments. They're very adaptive. They reproduce every 20 minutes. So they're very, very adaptive in the way that they live. And they excrete and re-engineer whatever it is, the substrate that they find themselves in. So soil, they go through the soil and they'll take a leaf and they'll nom 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 it down. And you can literally watch it in some of those videos where it's an interplay between the insects and the bacteria and the fungi. You can see fungi are involved in this. This is an ecosystem. And we evolved so closely with this ecosystem that we are part of this ecosystem. So just to put it in perspective, when we give birth, we turn and we face backwards. And birth is not a pretty sort of, you know, clean. We don't come out like they do in the films. You know, you see the baby come out, it goes wee, and it's all lovely and clean. That isn't what happens. The baby is covered in a slimy mixture of blech that's come out of mum and often come out of your digestive system. And essentially, I guess you get your first gut microbiome transplant as you are born. Now you're born to, if your vaginal bacteria are balanced, and this is quite important, your vaginal bacteria, if you're born correctly, you get Bifidobacterium infantis. Interestingly, one of the bifidobacteriums that we see as a psychobiotic. Now, your Bifidobacterium infantis is like your very first bacteria that's hanging out there, and it wouldn't survive if we, and I say we women, didn't, and I'm pointing at these, we feed them. And the breast milk contains sugars specifically to feed this bacteria. Now, Bifidobacterium infantis is best described as one of those people, if you think of personality-wise, Bifidobacterium is that personality that is like the party organiser. He's like, come on in, I got cocktails, it's lovely in here, it's nice and warm, it's milky and acidic, there's some sugars if you want, so come on in, the party's here. And the Bifidobacterium infantis is like the party organiser. It's like, come on in. And your baby will spend the first 3 years of its life gathering bacteria to set up its gut microbiome. And this gut microbiome is really set for life by the time it's about three. Now, once you watch a baby, and my daughter's a great example of this. I remember being a new mum, and I was guilty as any mum at the time of making sure everything was clean. I was very important that everything was clean. I remember being horrified. I walked into the sitting room, and she was there going, nom, 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 nom. And I thought, what is she eating? And she had found under the sofa, how it got there, I have no idea, was the most disgusting, mouldy apple core. We're talking, it'd been there about 3 weeks. Oh dear. She was nomming on it. And I remember thinking, oh, what's going to happen? I think she was about maybe 10 months old. And I rang my mum and I went, what am I going to do? Should I take her to the doctors? At the time, I was quite panicked because I thought maybe she was going to make herself really ill. And my mum went, don't worry about it. She said, it does some good. She said, they're supposed to have a speck of dust. This was the horror of the fact that she'd been on that. But actually, if you look at babies when they're first born, they cram anything into their mouth. They are literally biologically, it's like, right, what can I get into my mouth? An old shoe, a carrot, your apron, what can I get in my mouth? And what they're actually doing is, I believe that they're actually getting as many microbes as they can, because you're training your immune system to what is friend and what is foe. And during this time, they create a balance in the gut microbiome, and this is actually the center of our gut and the way in which we evolved is to have this symbiotic relationship with the soil, the microbes, and we ourselves actually evolved with that, with those microbes. Now, these microbes are coexisting with us. And often I hear people saying they were our first gut, our second gut, but actually our first brain, second brain. I think that, we actually evolve with our gut first and then we evolve cognitively. So I don't think that it's possible to say that they are our second brain. I think they were our first brain. That's how I think we evolved. Now, these microbes that are in our gut are the same microbes that we find in the soil. They're the same families of microbes. And the same families of microbes in the soil are the same kind of microbes that you find on your skin, microbiome. And we were talking earlier about the fact that if you live in the countryside, you can have a wider diversity of microbes on your skin. And it's significant because the wider the diversity of the microbes in your gut, the more robust your health. This was the American gut study that showed this. Now, coming back to seeds and coming back to what I was talking about is methylation of vitamins, germination and fermentation, as in fermenting your sourdough, are all the same process. Now, this is something for the vocabulary of this, sprouting, germination, fermentation, methylation is one process. It's not, they're not separate things. The mechanisms are the same. And I think this actually creates massive gaps in our knowledge and understanding of the system and the food, because we've actually separated the same wording for the same process and people don't understand it because they think it's four separate things. It's not. What I want to explain is how this is all one thing and why. And when you mill grain into a bag of flour, people stop seeing it as a bag of seeds. They see it as a bag of flour and they go, oh, it's a pretty picture. It's got 13 and a half protein on there. It's a bag of flour. If you stop seeing it as a bag of flour and actually see it as a bag of ground up seeds, it will change the way you understand what you're baking with. You're not baking with flour, you're baking with ground up seeds. Now, when you put ground up seeds in some water, what happens? Your seeds go, oh, we've been waiting around for months. We've got this water. We're going to grow. Now, they have no idea at this point that they've been ground up into a bag of flour. They think that they are a seed. And they go, let's go. All the processes that make a seed grow in the soil happen when you put your flour and your water and your sourdough starter into your bowl. Now, when you drop a seed into the soil and it rains and there's water, what happens is your seed goes, we're growing! And they have all these component parts in the seed to make it grow. The most important one of these, and they're all part of this, is actually in a relationship between microbial activity and enzymic breakdown. So when you put your starter in to your dough, that is like the microbes in the soil. And what happens is the microbial activity is triggered with these enzymes. And this enzyme, or these enzymes, there's lots of different enzymes, they break things down. And what they do is they break down the seed and the carbohydrate in the seed. And that's that carbohydrate that's in white flour, it's just carbohydrate. And they break it up like Edward Scissorhands. So that water releases hundreds. Remember Edward Scissorhands? Do you remember the movie? Mm-hmm. Hundreds of enzymes who are going to chop everything up. And they start chopping and they chop up these pieces of starch. Starch does not ferment. What is absolutely key is that the fermentation of this starch is actually not going to happen unless you have this water trigger and enzyme, because the enzymes transform the starch into sugar. This is your middleman. Without the enzymes, without that water trigger, nothing's going to happen. And it triggers the enzymes, and the enzymes start chopping into starch. And as the starch starts to break down, those microbes, either in the soil or in the starter or the plant itself, they start to produce bacteria generation. The starch is sugar. The sugar feeds the bacteria and the yeast, and they start kicking out acid. They kick out lactic acid and acetic acid, and they acidify. Now, the acidity that these bacteria kick out changes the pH. Now, as the pH is changing, the acidity kicks up a new set of enzymes. The first set are called amylase. They break down starch. It's in your saliva. As the acidity lifts, the next lot are triggered. It's like a whistle being blown. Your turn, and your turn is the proteolytic enzymes, protein breakdown. This is really interesting because the protein breakdown are the second meal for the baby plant. First meal is the starch, goes into sugar, and the plant's like, hello, I'm awake. I started growing. Oh, I've eaten my sugar. What's next? Now, as a time capsule, what's next is the proteolytic enzymes that break down the protein, and the protein is the gluten. And the gluten forms when the gluten and the gliadin get wet and they bond like a strong gum, glue, and they bond quite hard because they are slower to break down, but the acidity and the proteolytic enzymes, now they've been triggered by the acid, start to go to work on these. And these are broken down. The gluten is broken down for the baby plant. And the baby plant is given amino acids, bioactive peptides, and all of this lovely extra, chunks of building block that it can build itself with. So this gluten is a second meal for the baby plant, and it only gets released after the interaction between those microbes and the acidity triggers them. So it's like a delayed release. Now, when you get that acidity by the bacteria, whether that be in your dough or whether that be in the soil, it also triggers another enzyme. It's all about the enzymes, and this is why you need to understand it for your baking and for your nutrition. And this is the phytic acid. Now, the phytic acid has a chelating capacity. And what chelating capacity does is it grabs on to all the minerals and vitamins around it. So in the soil, it's going, right, our turn. Grab the copper and the iron and the calcium and the magnesium and the manganese and the zinc. And we pull it all in together. Oh, lovely. All here for the baby plant. And we release it. So the baby plant can get it. And that's the acidity that makes it. And that makes those vitamins and minerals more bioavailable. And this process of fermentation is also the methylation. It's when there's all that bioactivity going on, that is when you'll get that methylation of all of the B vitamins. Now, the only vitamin that doesn't increase during this process is probably vitamin E. It's slightly diminished. So this anti-nutrient breakdown, it's broken down the gluten, it's broken down the phytic acid because the phytase has been neutralised, which also makes you fart less because phytic acid makes you pass wind. This is all temperature sensitive. So like a plant, they grow in spring. It's the warmth that really kind of generates this activity. If it's freezing cold, or if it's 5 degrees in the fridge, it ain't gonna happen. So one of the things that we talk about a lot when we're baking is desired dough temperature. And we know that the yeast like it warmer, and then the microbes like it cooler. Now, I don't think this is an accident. I think this is day and night. And you see these temperature fluctuations on the planet day and night. And you see that some of them will come up in the day and some of them will come up as it gets cooler at night. And I think this is part of understanding the whole cycle of how this holistic approach to bread actually works. What you're getting during that germination and fermentation, same with the soil, is you get oxygen in the soil, that brings more life, that gets yeast and gas production from the yeast, because the yeast are feasting on the sugar and producing CO2, that makes your gas rise. But it also produces, it just produces a lot of gas, and it gives you a light, airy soil system. So people talk about the soil not digging up and ploughing it and releasing all the carbon from it. And this is where this carbon is in the soil. You know, we talk about carbon being released when we plough. And this comes back to regenerative farming practices, not ploughing everything up. Now, not in the sourdough, but in the network of the soil, you get these mycorrhizal fungi. And if you've got these good mycorrhizal fungi, there is an interaction. So what the plant starts doing is it starts excreting sugar into its roots. And that attracts these mycorrhizal fungi actually hang out in there, and they bring more nutrition into the plant. So if you've got a good soil system, you're actually going to get higher levels of zinc, magnesium, all of these minerals. This is to do with the relationship between the plant and the soil, the kind of nutrients you've got in your soil, which is why soil health really, really matters, because you're not going to get your micronutrients in your bread if they weren't in the soil, and you're not going to get them into your plant if you acidified the soil using all of the different fertilizers, because you're disrupting this exchange that goes on in the soil. And every time we ruin our soil, and every time we bring that soil system down, we're getting yield. No, we're not getting the micronutrients. As we know, these micronutrients are absolutely essential for our health and for our brain function and for our gut microbiome. Now, in the middle of all of this is the fact that we reduced our flour down to monoculture. It's so accepted that for the last 120 or 130 years, the global population of something like 70 billion of us, is that correct? I don't know, round about there. No one's questioned it. No one's gone, hold on a second, hello. Our most basic and staple food. Monoculture is just accepted. Even the bakers, who are quite revolutionary, going, yeah, look at my rye loaf. Mm-hmm. Look at my spelt loaf. Oh, look at my barley loaf. No, 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 no. Neolithic man did not wander around making a spelt loaf. Didn't happen. They put into the pot. We started by making porridges, patties, if you like. We probably didn't even bake them. They were probably patties that we grubbed together and that were easy to carry. They were probably ended up being baked on stones. But if you look inside the guts of people who have had their guts preserved, like, for example, Tolland man, you will see that he had 60 different plants in his gut, and 80% of it was barley. Now, I've picked out some of the plants. They're not particularly tasty. And he was sacrificed and then thrown in a bog. I was with somebody who knows the little girl that found them the other day. And it was very, very interesting to actually analyse what was in their gut. So my first case study, I argue, for diversity is Tolland man, because his gut showed me what he was eating. Now, I don't want to romanticise it. I'm sure it wasn't the most delicious thing in the whole world. I don't know. Maybe he did enjoy his last meal. But what I can tell you is this. We evolved microbially. We evolved with natural fermentation. We are so connected to the microbial process that our bodies ourselves, our actual bodies, are an interconnection with the gut-brain function, the vagus nerve. We are constantly actually in communication with our gut microbes. And our brains and our sense of being is connected in a way that our hormones and our thought processes are constantly messaging your gut. And your gut and your bacteria in your gut are manufacturers of the neurotransmitters that your brain needs to function correctly. Now, when you have an industrialized food system where your most basic food denies you fiber, denies you diversity, denies you the methylation that's needed to support people's genetics, and denies you blood sugar management and all of the component parts that you need to exist, then you have a system that is so utterly broken that actually what we consider to be bread is no longer recognisable. It is so far removed from it, it's untrue. The only way that we can actually put back and actually nourish people and reset the planet and the interrelationship with the soil and our nourishment from the soil and lower our carbon emissions, and the only way that we can reset our guts to prevent diabetes, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, obesity as well, inflammatory, all of these non-communicable diseases are actually fueled by this ultra-processed approach that we've got that began when we stopped the interplay between fibre, diversity and fermentation. And when you realise that the whole planet is microbial, it wouldn't surprise you that when we eat the microbes and we nourish our microbes and we live in unity with our microbes, then actually that is going to bring health and wellness. And it is that misunderstanding. So all of my work and everything I've ever done with my work looks at diversity in the environment, the fact that you find these natural peas and beans and legumes that naturally have all of the component parts in them, like the DAO that helps lower histamine, which is very debilitating. So these peas and beans and legumes, and they contain DAO, they contain folate, which when they're methylated or when they're sprouted or when they're fermented helps support what we call the MTHFR gene, which is associated with neurodiversity. And it also helps support the methylation system in the body to help it get rid of what we call homocysteine, which is this I would say waste product that has a pathway. And if you don't get your methylated B vitamins, especially folate, and you don't get the bioavailability, this also triggers a lot of inflammation, especially in people with these genetics. So I believe that the only way to fix the food system is to make these connections back again. And until we make these connections back again, we're basically building on a broken system. And if we can put it back into our basic food, back into the bread and the way that we eat the bread, then we can nourish at a very basic level. And I think this is where I think that the system is often by medical professionals. I end up seeing the same story over and over again, which is we have a broken system, and the panacea for the broken system is that the medics understand that we need this methylation, they understand we need the nutrients, but they're going to the pharmaceutical side and they're actually propping people's health up with a panacea of pharmaceuticals instead of moving back into the baseline nourishment and making those connections in at the very bottom. And so you're never going to fix individuals. They'll always be taking pills and supplements. And you're never going to fix the planet unless we can actually fix that foundation at the very start of where it all went wrong. So that's my job, is actually to actually get that message out there. And that's why I teach, to really get you thinking and understanding where we go to fix individuals and the planet. I hope that makes sense to you all, and why we need to do this. Nobody needs to stay in their lane. We have to cross into all the different disciplines to bring it all together, to have a complete understanding of the whole system. And that is why the Baking as Lifestyle Medicine protocol is holistic. There you go. Does that make sense to you all? And do you have any questions? Any particular questions? Did I cover anything in there that you think? Oh, I did a good job there.
Yeah,
did no questions? Go on.
How long it takes for us to change our microbiome? Like, if you have a not very good number of different kinds of, yeah, with food, with a good
nutrition. So most of the studies, when you say how long does it take to change your gut microbiome, you can actually start changing it in the next 5 minutes. So the second you start eating something, you're nourishing the particular microbes. Mm-hmm. So if you want to eat something that's not that good for you, you're going to be nourishing the ones that you don't want. And if you start eating something that's good for you, you start nourishing the ones that are good for you. And what you have in the gut, people like to think that they can change their microbes. It's very rare that you can change your microbes. What you can actually do is you can change the balance of your microbes. So you can nourish a particular lot of microbes that are good for you. So these are often what we call the butyrate producers. They produce something called short-chain fatty acids, and that's like an engine oil. And it actually surrounds your gut wall, and they live in this engine oil. It's a bit like butter, and that will provide food, nourishment, safety, and a lining that is actually providing a barrier so your tuna sandwich doesn't get through the gut wall. And this is often what's missing, because it's fiber that they use to make that. Now, in order to get those microbes to increase, you can start right now, but the proper changes that you will see, generally speaking, is about 3 months. So I did a 12-month dietary intervention study program. I suggest 3 months is when we see some significant changes. But it doesn't mean that you can't start right now. And I wouldn't suggest that you start with a very heavy dose of fiber. I would suggest that you're very nice to your microbes. If they haven't had fiber for a long time, it could be a bit of a shock to the system. They're like, oh, even if you fermented it and broken it down. Mm-hmm. So actually be gentle with your microbes. Mm-hmm. Do that fermentation for them. Do a lot of the breakdown for them, because what you're doing with your sourdough, with your kefir, with your kimchi, with your sauerkraut, with your chocolate, all of those are doing the job of your microbes in your gut for them. They're pre-digesting it. And by pre-digesting, what you're doing is you're borrowing enzymic activity for them to do that breakdown for your microbes. It's especially important when you have somebody with a gut microbiome who doesn't have the microbes in their gut to do this job.
And is that what we'll start to do on the course, where you said about the crowding out, once you
yes.
start to learn what's yeah. eating more, yeah. and you then start manipulating the bacteria populations?
Yes. And what we do is we actually crowd out histamine producers. We crowd out, sometimes you have to see crowding out of candida. So sometimes you'll have a particular set of bacteria. Sometimes it can come from the teeth. So sometimes if you've got a bad rotting tooth, it can actually trickle down and set off gang of microbes that you really don't want, and they're producing things in your gut that fuel inflammation. Mm-hmm. So they're basically We don't want to get rid of them completely because some of them actually have a role in small quantities. So they might be there to keep another pathogen out. So sometimes you don't want to get rid of them. What you want to do is you want a balance. It's about a balance in the microbiome.
It was interesting because you had the peas and then you said they contain the DAO, whereas peas are actually histaminic. So I was like, oh, it's interesting how nature works.
Yes, so they are until you sprout them. And then they got a very, very high level of DAO. Yeah. So sprouted peas is actually fantastic to lower your histamine. And often what I will do is create sprouted peas. Yeah, and also you've got your folate in there. So again, this is the same process where you see the DAO being produced as they're sprouting.
So how do you put that in the bread then?
We mill it as part of the botanical blend.
But if you're at home and you want to then use... Oh, it's in your botanical blend.
Yeah, and I will get you to mill your own flour or create your own. So you can put it in a coffee blender if you want to, or you can mill your own with a mill, or you can buy it in the botanical blend flour. So I encourage you, or you can even get some of these things, like, for example, I will say to you, it will send your bread a bit doolally because there's a lot of nitrogen in them. your bread might climb up out off the counter and run down the road because it's really, really nourishing for all of the microbes. Because that nitrogen is what we fix into the soil. That's why peas and beans and legumes are used to fix nitrogen into the soil, because it gets the next crop really growing. Woof. So before you plant your grain, you plant peas and beans and legumes. And it has the same impact with the yeast. The yeast basically just go yee-haw and they gallop off. So it's really, really nourishing. And then, so you can put them in, for example, if you didn't have a mill, I would suggest that you go and get some chickpea flour, which is also very, very good. So chickpea flour. But like I said, it can be quite wild for your fermentation. But we do ferments that are 100% chickpea. So, for example, we have some farinata pancakes from Italy that are 100% legume fermented. So you can actually just ferment. And in Iran, they also use a lot of fermented chickpea in their daily diets.
Interesting.
Yeah. It is very interesting. But once you start clicking and realising, you, especially as functional doctors and functional medics, you're suddenly like, oh, hang on a second. All this stuff that we've been learning and all of that knowledge that you have, you're actually going, oh, look how it was created before the pharmaceutical industry was invented.
When I did, like, 20 plus years ago, and I did my piece in the holistic therapy, and I did it about herbalism and how, like, modern medicine, they try to extract, like, but actually how in nature, like, everything is created in whole. Like, if you look at aspirin, but actually it has the anti-nausea bits in it, et cetera, et cetera. And the pharmaceuticals always want to isolate, and
which is this knowledge. It's talking about isolation of knowledge, and this is that this is transdisciplinary. So it trying to,
system as a whole.
Yes, you have a holistic system, and so as we've broken the system down, we've become more and more broken because people try and isolate it to monetize it, but you can't eat money. Money is actually not real. It's a figment of our imagination. Money does not actually exist. You can't eat, money is not actually real. We've created a structure around money. So even the structure that determines the structure that we actually interact on is based on something that isn't money. If you gave £20 note to my dog, he would just look at it and go, what is that? Because it's totally meaningless. It only has meaning. And in monetizing the system, we have then gone, how do we make more of this figment money? And then that actually draws down to how we can monetize this to make, to sell this to you. But what's really funny is if you look at microbial equality as a theory, it's probably the most disruptive theory on the planet, because microbial equality says that the pharmaceutical industry and the food industry shouldn't be monetizing what's already ours. They can't, they're trying to monetize our fresh air and our clean water. Oh, they have done that, haven't they? Sorry. But they certainly are monetizing what is already ours. You already have these microbes in your gut and on your hands and in the soil. These are already yours as your human right. Yeah. So there you go. It also means that we can make fantastically digestible, easy, delicious bread, and it makes some fantastic flavours in the bread. And it means that we can make our basic food more nourishing, more delicious, just really, really good bread. And it's something that is, like I said, it's already yours. The microbes are on your hands, they're in the air, they're in the soil underneath your feet. It's already yours. You just need to know how to use it. There you go.
Thank you.
What do you think? Right. So there you go. So that is going to